Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with Charlie Ratton and myself, John Massey. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, everybody.
Today, we're going to return to one of our regular stomping grounds, which is offshore wind. I don't think we've talked about it specifically recently. There's been quite a lot going on, particularly here in Europe, particularly here in the UK. Charlie, do you want to sort of kick off? There were some things that you've mentioned that you wanted to raise, particularly around what's been happening here in the UK recently with offshore wind.
Yeah, I mean, we did the podcast on round four, what happened at the round four bidding day, which seems in a different world pre-lockdown days now. But the process carried on in the background. It wasn't much delayed. The Crown, I think, had done a pretty good job in London on keeping that pretty much on the rails. But I think we've got the first results, as they used to say, how they say, strictly are in. And there have been a few surprises, John, on the UK round four leasing round, and they've had a few knock-on effects on the siblings north of the border as well. So I suppose if you were to say what is the round four result in a nutshell, I suppose it's very good news for my region, really, which is the Northern Powerhouse region. It's one of these great new names that seems to be coming. I don't know whether somebody's generating all names like Poseidon and Gigastack and all cryo batteries and now the Northern Powerhouse, which has been around a while, to be honest. But it's very good news for the Northern Powerhouse region, because of the 8 gigawatts, which is massive in historical UK terms, to be leased, the bulk of it does come in what you might call the Northern Powerhouse region. Where is that? Well, that's off the east coast, off Grimsby and Hull, places we know well, and also closer to me on the west coast. So we're talking Morecambe Bay, Liverpool Bay, the Irish Sea, between here, Scotland, North Wales, Liverpool Bay, and across to the Isle of Man. Big leasing grounds both, which is, I suppose, it's very good news for the Northern Powerhouse region, perhaps less good news for some of the other regions that were in the mix, if you like. But it's had one really unusual impact, which we'll perhaps go into in a little bit more detail, and that's north of the border. Because, as you know, there were a number of leasing rounds in the UK. Boris Johnson said, well, we're going to raise the figure for the UK from 30 gigawatts to 40 gigawatts by 2030, which more or less represents a quadrupling of offshore wind installed capacity from where we are now. Absolutely eye-wateringly ambitious. And now here, the first tranche of that has come, and it's in the Northern Powerhouse region. So what are your thoughts on that initially?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just eyeing the round four results as you were speaking. I mean, a few things kind of struck out at me. I mean, one is actually how few of them there are. I mean, I guess that's one thing. There are 6 projects. Which basically has successful bidders. I mean, when we're talking about that, the kind of, as you say, 8 gigawatts in the past, you'd think 8 gigawatts, that must be like 20 projects or something, but it's 6 projects, 4 or 5 of which are 1,500 megawatts proposed capacity. So one thing is scale. It certainly shows the issue of scale, how big these things are getting. Another thing that obviously made the news was BP. Winning a couple of those, big part of that. And the final thing, which you probably can go into a bit more detail on, is, yeah, the thing about the price, these were different in as much as they have this option fee, which you pay each year from now when you've won the auction, to pay the particular option fee. It's a fee you pay each year up to when the thing comes on commission. And so if you can get it built and commissioned in a few years, you'll pay a lot less than if it takes you 7 or 8 years to get commissioned. So it brings in some uncertainty and some extra cost potentially to the development side of things. And also, I guess the thing that's kind of leapt out was the amount of money in some of those fees. Certainly that it's had an impact north of the border. Again, I'm sure you can talk a bit more about Scotland.
I think one thing
that came out was the amount people were bidding for these option fees, which, again, just looking at the table here, anywhere between 76,000 pounds per megawatt per year. And remember, these are 1500 megawatt programs, so we're talking about a lot of money, up to 150,000 pounds per megawatt per year. So 154,000 pounds per 1500s of your megawatts every year from now until you develop it. So that's a big, it's a big chunk of money.
Yeah, I think the Crown has actually capped it. There's a certain amount of years that you pay for, because obviously these developments can take a time and there can be unexpected delays and HRAs and things like that to troubleshoot. So I think there's a bit of a cap, but I think you really hit the nail upon the head. When I talk to the Crown, obviously they obviously tell you informally a lot more than you can perhaps go into the public domain with. But one of the concerns was that because we've got newcomers, we've talked about them in many of our podcasts, haven't we, about how oil and gas is coming in and transitioning, and the old ideas of absolutely doing it on a shoestring are perhaps now going. People are taking a much wider business. They're looking at the existing asset base. They're looking at how it works for the wider picture for the company or organization. What can be repurposed? Can they repurpose platforms or pipelines? Can they avoid decommissioning costs? So the figures that you mentioned are high, and I did notice. I was looking through the six, which I'll read them out. We've got a couple off the Scarborough coast, northeast of Scarborough, as it says, and those are RWE. Now that's the old new. So that's effectively E.ON as well, because E.ON and RWE are effectively one and the same. They've just been rebadged a little bit. So that's good to see the utilities in there. There's the Green Investment Group and Total off the Humber and Lincolnshire. So that's perhaps Total, big, going strong at the moment. You've got one under North Wales. Now, this one reversed into round four, really. It wasn't really part of the final four or final six that made the cut, but it was in earlier rounds. There were 18 of these zones at the start. The Crown picked the front runners, kept everybody informed, and some of the other 18 might reappear in different dates when some of the background is troubleshot. But this one is off the north of Anglesey, ENBW and BP. And then you've got a couple off the Lancashire coast, off my beat, Blackpool and south of Morecambe Bay. Now, this one is interesting in that they include a company, a JV, between Cobra Instalaciones Service. But interesting, I think, is flotation energy. So that might give an indication of what kind of kit might be going out there in the Irish Sea. So that is moving from perhaps a fixed to a floating
scenario. And that's the smallest one. That's 480 megawatts.
Yeah.
The rest are all 1,500. That would still be enormous for a floating one, though.
Yeah. And the last one is Barrow, which is a big wind farm area west of Morecambe Bay, ENBW and BP again. So it's not Dong, it's not Ørsted in the coming, but it's actually BP again. And I wonder whether that might be related to some of the wider issues that are hinted at there. So we can see that BP has actually come in very, very strong here. I don't see any Shell in there, but I do see both Total, which is worthy of comment, BP worthy of comment, and then this floating one as well. So floating is perhaps now coming into the UK. Oh, it's not UK, it's England and Wales waters here on my doorstep in Liverpool Bay in the west of Blackpool, which is quite a big step forward for the round four. Bear in mind, when I went to the first round four meeting, there was no talk. It was going to be fixed only. They work, we can get them in, we'll leave innovation elsewhere in the UK, which I'd like to touch upon in a moment. So I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's higher fees, much higher in some respects than people were expecting. Big, big now scale oil and gas majors in, and floating in England as well. So three or four big. I've not seen anybody pick up on some of the nuances of that, what it really means. Perhaps I'll bash out an article if I get time in coming days. But that is a big leasing. We're talking billions of pounds worth of investment for the Northern Powerhouse area, well into the 20s of billions when these are have gone through the process and built out. So any further comments on that list?
Obviously the high fees has generated a lot of noise, and what always happens, because it harks back a little bit to in a previous life many moons ago, I was in the mobile phone industry, and I was in the mobile phone industry at the time the infamous or famous, depending which side of the fence you were, 3G auctions, where Gordon Brown, I think for the first I think it was the last time the UK government's ever had a budget that was not in deficit for the year. And a big chunk of that was because they raised, I can't remember what the number was now, in today's terms, probably not a huge amount, but it was a few tens of billions of pounds auctioning licenses for mobile phone spectrum. And it made lots of noise and lots of complaints at the time that these companies were paying too much and it would kind of bring a halt to 3G and so on. Of course, the counter argument to that is that those licenses were worth a lot of money and companies weren't being forced to bid for them. It was an open auction. They could have said it's too expensive. But what it kind of showed was the value of what was being bid for. The reason the prices went high was that those companies saw them as essentially the license, in that case, the access to spectrum, and in this case, the access to seabed in areas of high wind as being critical, of being high value. They're things of high value. If you don't have them, you've not got a business to develop. So you could argue here that what the high prices show, actually, given that, again, it was an open auction, no one's holding a gun to your head saying you have to pay this amount of money, people are bidding it. It's kind of showing how valuable some of these prime areas are. It's showing the amount of demand, the amount of companies out there that want to be in offshore wind. So the amount of money, the amount of finance, and particularly, as you say, some of these new companies or new to offshore wind, the BPs and the Totals, it's kind of showing the value that they place on getting into the offshore business and in getting, if they don't have licenses, you can't get into the offshore business unless you've got a license. So it's the high prices to me are really an indicator. It's supply and demand. You've got a limited supply of sea and you've got huge demand from companies with very deep pockets wanting to get into it.
Yeah, I mean, in the energy world, you come across a few euphemisms, I suppose. And one of the euphemisms that you come across is show us signs of commitment. So you might say, well, actually, some of these oil and gas companies, they come from a different, they're not regulated. The utilities always have a regulated arm, so they always have to justify, almost every penny. It doesn't always seem like that, but that is the case. Not just to the regulator, but perhaps to other people as well, that they've got value for money. But I suppose if you're coming from a big oil, big gas project delivery, and you need to get into the market, you're going to say, I'm not going to mess about. So one of the crowds, as I say, I always talk to people informally as well as formally, was actually there's been a bit of a distortion. Yeah, the utilities have led the charge in the UK, Yarns and so forth, and they've done a good job. They've got 10 gigs built out. Obviously, that was subsidised in some form, certainly supported, continues. But now you've got a new breed, and some of these companies, all right, they might have a bit of onshore experience. I'm not aware, sure. Wind farms being built by BP or Total, but it's a mature industry. They're confident, they can buy in the skill sets, they can learn, they can acquire. And like you say, they might take a bigger picture of what works well. If there is a transition in place, some of these companies have been buying bits in the jigsaw acquisitions for years, haven't they? They've invested in electric vehicle tech sometimes. They've got existing assets out there, and now they've come in. And obviously, I think the feeling is that the England and Wales round, they're an anchor, a world anchor, great record of project delivery, perhaps a little bit cautious. But my word, they've got this stuff delivered. So if you come in, I think the expectation is that you deliver it. Mm. You do need deep pockets. I think one of the criteria was that you needed to show £80 million in the bank, mm-hmm. which scares off your SME and some of the smaller agile developers, unless they become part of a JV. Of course, so that might be a smart move for some of the
they've paid deposits. It lists the deposits paid. That's anywhere from 44 up to £231 million. So yeah, deep pockets required, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the differences between this and a non-state or a non-crown estate funded, it's largely been de-risked. They've already talked to stakeholders. They already know that the grid isn't a problem. They know real. So there might be an HRA, a habitat kind of research element to it, but there's no real showstoppers left. So if you do come in, there's every expectancy, if you like, that you deliver, and you deliver in a timely manner as well. So very quick rollout times. But a few unintended consequences is what I wouldn't mind coming on to next. First of all, I was pleased to see a couple of utilities still in there, including my old company E.ON, who are now badged as RWE or whatever the entity is, but it is still my old colleagues at Yum. Good luck to them. But the other one that you mentioned in the preamble was was one that seems to have been going on forever, which is ScotWind. Now, ScotWind is a 10 gigawatt leasing round, which has now been paused. What would you like to, what are your initial remarks on that?
Well, again, I think it's what the round four has basically shown the Scots, and the reason they paused it, is the the value of the asset that they have, the value of the seabed, the leasing areas that they have. And so my understanding is that the reason they paused it is that they're legally obliged to basically obtain what they call market value for the seabed that they're leasing. And so the prices that they talked about before, they've basically shown that, well, we could be getting way more than that. Why are we leasing them for only, I don't know what the numbers were, what numbers they were talking about, but it was substantially less than we're talking about here. Basically what this auction, because auctions are all about what they call price discovery, it's basically discovering how much people are prepared to pay, it's discovering the market value. The Scots have seen, well, hang on about, the market value of our our leasing areas are much higher than we thought they were going to be. So we shouldn't be, we can't just hand them out for what we were talking about before. We need to have a rethink, and we need to, and what will, what you're ultimately looking at is prices that are going to be much higher. The industry, obviously the industry perspective on that is, oh no, it's too expensive, we want them cheaper. But then you've got to flip it around on the other side and say, well, if you're the resource holder, why should you be handing them out on the cheap if companies have shown a willingness to spend way, way more on it?
Yeah, I suppose if you just took a hard-nosed viewpoint, that would be the case. A few nuances perhaps worth worth interjecting here. And one is that I think ScotWind always looked at a wider social dimension, which is perhaps laudable. So it might look to innovating, and it might look at just starting up new elements of the economy. I went up there, what seems like, to be honest, if ScotWind goes any slower, we're going to be at decommissioning stage if they carry on at this rate of knots. But a couple of years ago when they started it, there were a whole heap of scenarios. There were going to be fish farming and offshore wind, you name it, and some other thing. And it was a different consultant leading it as well, which raised question marks. Suddenly they were no longer involved. Having developed in Scotland, I suspect that there's some quite vociferous stakeholders up there as well. And then it was delayed and delayed and delayed, delayed for about 2 years. Finally, it's within a month of the results, like round four, and then suddenly pulled. Now, I think if I was charitable, I think a positive thing that I might say is a degree of naivety. Every time I go to these meetings, I've been to just about them all, is that they always make great play, certainly in London, of welcoming their Scotch kind of siblings and say, here, it's great to have this. So that begs the question, did the Crown Estate Scotland see this coming? And if not, why not? There is that awful football chant of you don't know what you're doing that you hear from time to time. And I certainly hope that's not the case here, because if I was somebody that spent months now, possibly even years in some of the ScotWind leasing rounds, modelling, doing your sums, all the budgeting, getting people in place, assuring the supply chain, getting your sums, getting your budget, going to board approval, and then suddenly, sorry, paused. And I think the expectancy, as you've just indicated, isn't that it's going to be when it's unpaused, which I'm sure it will be, that it's going to be the same fee. You might find a doubling or a trebling. And that's not going to go down terribly well with people that have been engaged with this process for the best part of 3 years.
Yeah, no, for sure. As I say, the industry is not going to be terribly chuffed around it. But as I say, my understanding is the reason they paused it is that they, in the terms of their of whatever the act that covers it is, they're actually legally obliged. And again, it's this term to not to sell a lease unless they're getting market value. And so what the view from the policy side is that clearly they weren't getting market value for whatever reason. They've underestimated the value. They've now been shown some evidence from elsewhere that these things are actually more valuable than they thought they were. And so if they leased them for a smaller price, they'd actually be, I guess someone could challenge them in court. Someone could go and say,
yeah, I wonder, I mean, given well, some we'll touch upon later. I suppose I can take all of that. Yes, that's all very reasonable. I think the late nature of it is what strikes me as odd,
yeah.
That you're within a month now of effectively the announcement. So it's been pulled at almost literally the 11th hour. And if you've been a company putting resources into this, and then suddenly we've got everything in place, and then suddenly indefinite pause as well, so nobody's even quite sure when it's going to... So if you're a company, you might say, well, to hell with this, I'm pulling out. I'm going to go to... I'm going to focus my resources elsewhere. In fact, if you're a company that's bid for one of the rounds that we've just mentioned, if you're a BP or Total or some of the other companies, and I would be surprised if some of those names are not also in the Scott firmament, you might say, well, I'm going to concentrate my efforts. Let's get these builds. The Crown Estate London seems to know what it's doing. They're not faffing us about. We know what we're going to pay. It's a bit more than we thought. Let's go down and do it and worry about Scotland if and when it comes out of this, well, what you might call a temporary pause.
Yeah, although the bigger prices, of course, would favour the bigger companies anyway. So they might take the view that, oh, well, we have to pay more, but that's the price for getting competitors out of the market. I think, I mean, the late notice is because round four only, the results were only 10 days ago, weren't they?
I think the surprise was, to my mind, having been so close to it, is that the Scottish Crown seemed to be caught out. They didn't seem to anticipate this. They weren't ready for it. I mean, they didn't even hint, I suppose, the commercial confidentialities and stuff. But suddenly, almost a day after, to put their own leasing round, come on, guys. You're supposed to be, well, they were one organisation until very, very recently. Every time you go and talk, they make great play of how they're working together. But here, the first concrete example, if you like, of two separate entities, and one has put it on pause.
So, yeah, I mean, they've clearly underestimated what they thought the bids were going to be.
In a bigger picture, it will be sorted, I've no doubt. And you might say it's good news because the one has informed the other. You've got a more realistic commercial rate. Some of the other interests that we've named do have big interests up in Shetland and Orkney, so they're not going to be scared off by a few pounds of option fees in the bigger picture. The wind resource is terrific up there as well. And perhaps that commercial aspect will prevail, but which begs the question, why spend 2.5 years going through these torturous six scenarios, most of which have been kicked into the equivalent of the long grass? I think one of the ones that has survived is the hydrogen elements, but it seems to be, we were told it was going to be within 3 months, and that was 2.5 years ago, and here we are, and the situation is further back now than it was then, and Scotland was going to be a world leader. Now it's Boris Johnson going on the American press to say that Britain is good, or the England and Wales is now going to perhaps get that prize. But it just struck me as odd.
They've clearly underestimated what the prices were going to be. And again, you've got to kind of look at it from both sides. I mean, the innovation one is interesting, how they look to deal with that, whether they split out the leasing and deal with innovation slightly differently. As I say, the kind of devil's advocate approach, stepping outside the industry, and you mentioned social dimension. The social dimension is, well, why, if you've got companies like BP winning licenses, why should they get it for X amount when we know they've shown they're prepared to pay, I don't know, whatever the multiple is, 4 or 5 times as much, because that money comes into the treasury. We can use that to spend on social things. So I think you can look at the social dimension from both angles. Why should big companies underpay for a very, very valuable asset? But then I certainly agree on the innovation side. If you want to encourage innovation and you want to encourage a bit more involvement by a more diverse range of players, then the fees play into that. But I think they're talking about, again, I'm just looking, they update on the 24th of March. So we shouldn't have to wait months to find out what the next steps are for that.
Yeah, I don't think the stakeholders would wear much further delays after 2.5 years of it. The innovation, I think, was raised with the London Crown Estate, and I think there were some breaks on the option fee if you could show an innovation. The Scots has always had it, it's always been innovative, but there'd be far fewer offshore wind farms built in Scotland. I can only really think of part of Robin Rigg and now Beatrice. So there's far less, far fewer examples of successfully delivered projects, albeit with a much, much augmented. I suppose original drivers, let's not forget, for Scotland, which got a little lost, is it started out as a floating round. It was really one, and that was innovative. But that seems to have antagonised other elements of the supply chain. Hey, why focus on floating? We've built out fixed at your say so. We're the supply chain. We want fixed. So they kind of solved that by adding fixed floating and getting a massive leasing round, which has now become becalmed. From what you're saying, it's not the biggest becalming, but it sounds like there might be some scrambling behind the scenes in a slightly unseemly manner to unpick. If you were to be cynical and put a political dimension, we've talked about the economic dimension, and if you were to say, well, look, you know, I'm Boris Johnson, one of my tasks is to support those perhaps who voted for me. I'm thinking of my area, a lot of the seats here, what they call the Red Wall. Former Red Wall seats, and I think he's pledged to what phrases like level up. I've seen him use phrases out there that Alex Salmond used to use, like the Saudi Arabia of wind. These great phrases. But that
they'll be exporting much wind anytime soon. Yeah.
Well, it depends on what, if you can liquefy it or gasify it, John. But that's another discussion. But I suppose the point is, if you're Boris and wanted to do that as part of an industrial strategy, where better to reward than your northern powerhouse region, which is us, that voted for you? And if you were to be even more cynical and say, well, actually, you know, the talks of referendums and things entering the consciousness again, well, I don't know whether he thought that would be a bit of a blow for Scotland if we went down the purely commercial route down south. I don't even know whether that exists in the people that do the tectonics in the background. But it does seem, if you were to be dispassionate, that the Northern Powerhouse region has benefited almost from nowhere, and that the Scottish region has been slowed at the very best. Yeah, it's not got the impetus that it had 2.5 years ago, where it was going to be a trailblazer, innovative, it's going to be turned around 3 months. Here we are 2.5 years later, and it's now behind the Northern Powerhouse region, certainly with regard to published data that we've just been through.
I mean, Boris is famously not a details man, as they say. So I wouldn't be reading that much into it. But yeah, I mean the political dimension certainly plays a part. I suspect the Scotland thing, as I say, I suspect it's nothing more sinister than a scrambling around, thinking, hang on a minute, we've got A, these things are more valuable than we thought. B, we've got a legal obligation to sell them at so-called market value. And if we sell them for much less, someone's going to pop out of the woodwork and say, well, hang on a minute, you're not meeting your legal obligation to sell at market value and provide as much money to the Treasury. I mean, the political angle, I guess, would be the Scottish government might have suddenly sat up and thought, hang on a minute. I mean, again, depending exactly how the mechanics of ScotWind and the licensing fees and where they go. I mean, do they go to the Scottish government nationally, or do they come back?
I think it's devolved. I think that's why the Crown Estate Scotland was set up as part of the devolution. And in a way, it's good news, isn't it, that the asset is worth much more than people anticipated, with new people coming in to join incumbents, which is a very, very positive backstory. I just think it's been a little bit of, if you're a charitable, perhaps a little bit of miscommunication between the two branches of the Crown Estate. Obviously, we are in a pandemic, and who knows some of the bigger picture. But it does seem that obviously this idea of quadrupling the UK kind of installed capacity within a decade, it's another step towards that. I don't know whether they're going to relabel ScotWind as round 5 and then round 6, round 7, round 8. To follow, I think the Crown took the view that this is going to be a template going forward, and I suppose that template is something along the lines that we've just done, as some kind of auctioneering. Everybody seems, you know, CFD seems to have an auctioneering element, and this does bidding or reverse bidding, which makes some commercial sense, and that's how you can tease out.
I guess the being charitable bit is I think the prices exceeded what most people thought as well, and so I don't think anyone expected the auctions to go as high as they did. Again, that's completely parallel with the experience whenever it was 20 years ago now, isn't it? It's a long time ago when they had 3G auctions. No one in their wildest dreams or nightmares, again, depending which side of the fence you're on, thought the prices would go that high. So I think there's a bit of that. I think a bit of the being caught out is that you can have your analysts sitting there making kind of estimates of what they think the bidding prices are likely to be. But until companies actually start putting their money down on the table and putting their bids in. And also when you throw in the competitive element to that as well, and the kind of the not wanting to miss out bit, which is what, I mean, that's the reason why governments love auctions, because it's all about kind of getting companies to kind of either, depending which work, if it's prices, getting them to bid lower, if it's fees, getting them to bid higher, based not just on their kind of private economics, but also the fact that if they don't bid higher or don't bid lower, they're out of the market. So there's all that. There's also that psychological and that competitive element as well. So I think it's a bit of both. I think I'm sure we'll get lots more analysis of this over the next few weeks. But my understanding is that ScotWind, they underestimated how much their asset was worth, and no one expected, and everyone also underestimated how high the bids in round four would go. So you could argue the reality is probably somewhere in the middle.
You could certainly put an argument, actually, certainly if you're the treasurer, that this is actually very good news. It's a sign of confidence. It's a sign of the demand being there. You've got all the kind of blue chips that you would want to be there, people that know to deliver mayor projects, and it's exactly what you want to be as part of a vibrant industry with a clear future, and also a sign that the energy transition perhaps is gathering pace and is now getting real bids to underpin that. So let's not go too negative with some of the nuances. I think it's obviously very good news for my region in the northwest of England and sister regions as well. The phone hasn't stopped ringing, and I always have to scratch myself and look when I see Boris Johnson on American television extolling offshore wind and extolling hydrogen and saying the opportunities. But there we are. Yeah. So thank you.
It's supply and demand. I mean, it would be a much more worrying situation if there were no bids, or the bids were all massively low.
Yeah, kind of tumbleweed scenario. Companies that you've never heard of
If you've got big companies
on the back of that, so thanks for that analysis.
That's a good thing.
A couple of other things in the world of offshore wind besides these round four and ScotWind. And that's the energy islands. I don't know whether you've tracked this notion that actually, rather than put platforms out in the North Sea or individual assets, you might actually build an artificial island of some form, designate that as an energy island, and then see what happens. Now, there was some mirth, I must say, within the industry when these first appeared 5 or 6 years ago, but I suppose that now is changing, because a couple of them have been consented off Denmark, but one is actually now going into construction, and it seems to be, I'm not quite sure whether it's made of concrete or some kind of metallic structure, but it's a multi-million pound thing that appears to be moving at great pace. So what are your views on a few of the comments that I've seen out there in the world that I live in seem to have missed the point as far as I can see. They just look at the output and say, well, that's so many pounds per megawatt, what a waste of money. But I think they're missing the bigger picture. But let's see what your views on the island dimension is.
I mean, energy islands can mean different things, as first thing. I mean, I guess to step back a bit and just to tie it into another news item that just popped up today, and to tie back what we just talked about, we're talking about these 1,500 megawatt offshore wind farms. There was a news item today, which is basically the High Court here in the UK quashing a decision that had been made at government level, which basically potentially puts a stop to an 1,800 megawatt Vattenfall wind farm. And it's not, the problem isn't with the wind farm. The problem is with the onshore bit, which we've talked about before. It's off coast of Norfolk. It's a huge, 1.8 gigawatts, huge offshore wind farm. There's another one that's in the same area. And basically, these, building them offshore is fine, but once they come onshore, they've got to come onshore, and then they've got to build a big onshore grid connection back to a national grid transmission substation somewhere, however many kilometres into Norfolk. And what's put a stop to this, the thing that got to the High Court, was local objections to the onshore part. So I think, so one aspect of this, to kind of link that to your islands thing, is I think we're going to start to reach the limits at which each individual wind farm, especially these enormous ones, can build its own individual connection back to shore and then its own individual onshore 20 or 30 kilometres of digging, digging the either the roads up or digging fields up to lay a grid connection back to the shoreline. So one aspect of energy islands or hubs offshore is kind of just the offshore grid bit of it. So I think we're going to, again, that's less a cost per megawatt issue. That's a permitting and planning issue. It's all very well having something that looks cheap, but if you can't get it permitted and the High Court says you can't build it because you can't fit your grid connection, then you're nowhere. So I think one aspect to kind of offshore hubs, if you like, things that connect together offshore assets, one is likely to be around just simple grid connection. So if we're going to build all these offshore assets, we're not going to tie them all individually back to shore. They're going to have to link into some kind of offshore hub, and then that offshore hub will, so you have kind of one landing point and one onshore grid connection. So I think that's one aspect, and to some extent, I mean, the Germans already do that in terms of offshore substations where they link in multiple wind farms. But if you're going to do that on a bigger scale, maybe that substation isn't sitting on a monopile anymore, but it's so large, and you've got big interconnectors going off to Norway and the UK and Germany and wherever else, that actually becomes a more fixed energy island location. And if you're going to do that, of course, you could also attach to those energy islands, you can start to do some of the other things that no doubt you're going to mention in a moment, things like people talking about not even transmitting electricity back to shore from the island, but electricity to the island and then using the island to site electrolyzers and pipe hydrogen back to shore. Yeah. So I think the energy island things is kind of interesting. I'd kind of think of them as kind of energy hubs, places where you're basically aggregating input from a whole bunch of different things. It could, and in future it could be offshore wind farms, but it could be oil platforms, oil and gas platforms, and so on. And then you're providing either a link to forward that on either internationally or a single point to build, to put on a big scale back to shore.
Yeah, there's a lot in there, John, in your analysis. So I'd like to try and unpick it from a development point of view. First of all, I remember these things being first mooted right back at SSE about 10 years ago. I was going to events with even great, they had names like the Isles concept and things, where Ireland, Scotland and somebody else was going to come together with these first hubs that were largely electrical and largely grid-based. They seem to have morphed into a number, and I certainly get the feeling now that it's not one size fits all to these energy islands. Now, certainly seen some rather fanciful illustrations when the graphic artists get at these, and I think that might have distorted the narrative out there. Certainly some of the feedback I've seen out there in cyberspace comes from an engineering perspective, and they count up the number of turbines on them and think, well, there's 20 turbines, that means such, and it costs so many million pounds, what a waste of money. But I think that's not the picture, that's not what these things are about. The few things that you need when you're out in an extreme environment is perhaps somewhere safe. So you might need somewhere for accommodation. It may or may not be a repurposed platform or some kind of SOV, but you need somewhere perhaps hundreds of miles in some instances away, some accommodation element. You might want some kind of safe harbour. These, you know, when on an island, we had 127 mile an hour winds. Now, you don't always want to send your vessels back to its home port hundreds of miles away. You might want to just tuck it in a sheltered part of the island. Or you might say, well, actually, if we design our own energy island, we can design our own safe harbour to reduce steaming time, to reduce the economics of people traversing. So there's that element to it, which nobody's even touched upon. Then I think there's the grid element of yours. You've already mentioned public acceptance, isn't there? I think it was one person objecting. And it was always a hot potato, the onshore grid element of that project. So it was a bit of a known issue. But ultimately, you might have £5 billion worth of investment with all these talk of Saudi Arabia, of wind, hinging upon one person's objection. And in the longer run, is that really sustainable for an industry? I was always a bit cynical. We used to always look for nice, shallow entry points for our grids. And then, lo and behold, somebody would then designate your breach that you had in mind as a seal hall preservation area, and you couldn't use it, or you couldn't use it for 6 months of the year for the breeding season and so forth. And so it was always a bit of cat and mouse who was going to designate the next special protection or HRA just at the site that you'd chosen. So there's a bit of cynicism in the industry. As soon as you choose a site, lo and behold, a year later, it's designated, and bang, you can't use it. So it's perhaps the energy islands. And I've seen various versions of these. Some seem to be permanent structures. I've looked in some of the Dutch strategies and the Danish ones. And some seem to be almost semi-real. I'm not sure whether they're filled with sand or whether they kind of how they're made. But I've also seen versions that seem to be almost like floating structures, which seems to be the first one. I'm not sure whether it's some kind of concrete caisson thing. It does seem to have a harbour. But I think those people that just look and count the wind turbines on them are completely missing the point as to what the real function, which might be as some kind of joined up grid reconstituted Isles project, which has been around for 9 or 10 years already in a new guise, or it might be an accommodation, or it might be a harbour, or it might be some ammonia production facility. Who knows? I mean, not everybody wants an ammonia plant in their doorstep, or there might be some other reason yet to emerge why a place. Of course, we've got real islands. One of the underpinnings of ScotWind is why have an artificial island? We've got real islands. Come to Shetland, and I suppose that was a driver. Islands can be expensive places, especially with diesel shipped in. But now I think we'll have to wait and see. Somebody's made a business case out of it, and it certainly doesn't. If anybody thinks from an engineering point of view that just counting the number of turbines, looking at the output and thinking that's the whole of the business case, I think they're miles away from the reality of it.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to have multiple, as you say, multiple uses. They're going to be different. One island won't be the same as another one in terms of what those uses are. And as I say, I think where they become interesting is when they combine not just electricity, but potentially electricity with gas, either continuing gas or potentially going forwards, combining electricity with hydrogen or repurposed gas fields, or combining electricity with hydrogen with carbon capture and storage. I mean, whatever fits the location best. But I think ultimately it's about, I'd kind of see them in terms of their kind of points of aggregation from an energy point of view. But then, as you say, on top of that, you can build on top of that, having built a structure which is a sort of aggregation point for energy or a conversion point for energy. And on top of that, once you've built it, why not have a harbour, have a operations and maintenance centre, have a whatever else is there. There's no point. If you're going to the expense of building it, it's not going to cost you much more to have an extra hut over here that with some computers.
Well, if you're cynical, you could almost say, well, I've built the thing. You come and tell me what you want and have a kind of auction type of thing and say, well, here's some space. Close to the wind farm. You tell me what you want to, if you want some power to gas or if you want some maintenance facility. Of course, I suppose there's a bit of a downside to it. I mean, it's all very exciting and glossy and all the graphic artists are out there as well. But if you're a port like Grimsby and spent the last 20 years building up your capability to deliver all of this, you might not be too thrilled if somebody says, actually, I'm going to put one of these energy islands off the coast. We're going to ship people in from all over to do all these things that you might have thought, you know, we're going to build a floating wind factory. Who knows what's going to be put on these energy islands?
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought. It's hard to see how they would compete ultimately with some of those ports. I just think the scale that people are talking about, I just don't see them being on that scale. Because some of the ports, particularly things like offshore wind, you're looking at kind of the kind of dock lengths and all that kind of stuff, and maybe the water depths, depends where in the world you are, just the scale of it. So, but as a temporary measure, as a kind of staging, it's more of a kind of staging post, I would say, rather than a kind of replacement for Rotterdam or Grimsby or whatever.
I think I'm inclined to agree. You're more likely to have a few CTVs based there, crew transfer vessels, and the steaming time is a lot less to the turbine, so you can be much more economic, because all of that needs to be reckoned into a project. How long does it take? What are the tides? You're free of the tidal constraints. You're free of a whole heap of constraints. If you can choose where you put this, perhaps it'll be a movable island. I don't know. Perhaps you'll anchor conquer it and then shift it around once one's projects are certain. But I think it's an interesting development from the industry. Stuff that was laughable and ridiculed almost is now people just not batting an eyelid on it. A couple of other things that have happened since we last talked on Offshore Wind, John. One is, of course, there's been an election in the United States and perhaps some shift of emphasis there.
And yes, I think most people could notice.
Any remarks on
bits of election news?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it took a while to go through, didn't it? It wasn't the smoothest of a process. It seems to be there, and there does seem to be a new shift of emphasis. Yep. Would you agree with that? Even so much so that Boris reported last week. So I think it's good news.
I've not followed in detail kind of the announcements coming out of the States in terms of specific policies, but I mean, undoubtedly there's going to be a shift of emphasis, should we say, on the energy side. So yeah, I would have thought that would be good news for our sector, certainly.
Yeah, that's right. And it perhaps release some of the things on the East Coast. People are now looking at to the Gulf of Mexico, see if there's anything can be done. Some of the things that we've talked about, repurposing asset, energy transition, possibly a bit of hydrogen, hurricane proof, which we need. I know that the Far Eastern market has certainly looked at typhoon proof, hurricane proof kit over the years. And perhaps that needs to be accelerated if that's to be rolled out. But some interesting development. It all seems to be happening, doesn't it, in the world of offshore wind at the moment. And obviously there are leasing rounds. I think the German leasing round doesn't even have an electrical connection as part of some of the sites that they've and zones that they've put out. So they're obviously going down perhaps a power to X route, and perhaps the energy islands will come in. Poland is starting to interest people as well, and other parts of the world as well. So it's not just us. And I suppose if I was to return to ScotWind, it's not a dynamic place. If you wait 2 years, I'm not saying they've wasted 2 years, but if you delay projects 2 years, it's not a static field. You'll find that other countries are moving ahead now. And if you're a high, hard-nosed investor, you would say, well, yes, ScotWind's still of interest to us, but so is XYZ. And now things are happening on the east coast of America, and now round four is moving away, and there's movements in Australia and elsewhere as well. So there's going to be a lot more choice for these big oil and gas majors, if you like, as to where to site their infrastructure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think over the next 3 or 4 years, probably the main news, if anything, is going to come from growth outside, just to see where that happens, where that takes off. I mean, well, certainly in 3 or 4 years, China will have overtaken. It's already overtaken Germany, I think. It will have overtaken the UK as the biggest offshore market. But I think of more interest is going to be some of the kind of smaller, if you like, more emerging offshore wind markets, seeing what's happening there. I think we'll still, being established here, I think Northern Europe, a lot of people will be looking at in terms of some of the innovation, as to where some of the innovation happens. And also, I guess, if you're those big companies, I don't think you're it's not even necessarily a case of trading off Scotland against Vietnam or whatever it may be. It's the fact that it's just more markets. It's more opportunities for growth. So, I mean, Scotland will still, the thing that Scotland will still has is fantastic wind resource. Yeah. And so I don't think there'll be some wrinkles along the way, but I think fundamentally, I think the value of those leases.
That's right. It's got a great engineering heritage, fantastic wind resource, good attitude to getting projects done, perhaps ScotWind accepted. And I'm sure that it will sort itself out sooner. It has to, doesn't it? Because otherwise the world won't just stand still waiting for ScotWind. It's a great price, 10 gigawatts, but there are plenty of other, for example, some of the figures around Gulf of Mexico isn't 10 gigawatts. 500 gigawatts is being mentioned. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be 500 gigawatts built out. It never will. But if you get a fraction of that, a third of that, it's still a massive prize. And that what with political change, that who knows what the tectonics might be. Is there anything else you want to add, John? Quite a wide-ranging discussion on offshore wind. It's been a while since you called it our old stomping ground. Well, it's been a while since we've stomped over our ground. Yeah. I think we've given a few people a good old stomping. I'm not on certain people's Christmas card lists this year, I suspect, but there we go.
I think we've covered some of the most recent stories. I mean, there's obviously lots of detail we can come back to in future podcasts. And we'll certainly come back to things like floating and so on, when there's a bit more clarity around where some of that's going to go and some specific project announcements and so on. But in terms of some of the issues that have arisen, we've certainly gone over those. So I think we've done our 50 minutes or so as usual. So it's probably a good time to let people go and get on with the rest of their lives rather than listen to us.
I suppose if our listeners can stomach 50 minutes of their choosing, if they've got something they would like us to cover with the microphones, we're opened up. I think we've had a good response, haven't we? We've covered all kinds of biofuels and nuclear, and it's given us an insight into different markets. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, okay. We'll leave it for there, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Bye.